Well, think of the events, you know, in Syria. No one that I know of was predicting that Assad would fall in the matter of days, and you would have Iran's chief pal in the Middle East disappear into the smoke. And by the way, Russia getting pushed back as well, because that was Russia's partner there and those Russian military bases in Syria. So you can have, I mean, the surprises happen and that changes the balance. So you don't know. And I think you could reasonably call that a change on the positive side, but who knows what the next war will look like.
This is Searching for America. I'm Robin Kurno. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2025. It's certainly going to be rocking and rolling, isn't it? Particularly with a Trump administration with a clear set of priorities, promises, and I don't know, threats as well. With that in mind, I thought I'd ask my former colleague from CNN, Jim Sciutto, to join me to give his perspective and a bit of his thoughts on what we might expect from the Trump administration when it comes to foreign policy. Jim is CNN's chief national security analyst and anchor of a CNN show called Newsroom. He's also the author of a couple of books. The latest is called The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War.
It's interesting because I came to the idea for this book as I was in Ukraine during the start of the full-scale invasion in February 2022. And it struck me that while the ingredients of this return of great power competition had been boiling and evident for some time, that was an inflection point where a country, Russia, was attempting to redraw the borders of Europe, in fact, absorb an entire sovereign nation of Ukraine, the largest European nation, by force of arms, by rolling tanks across the border and burning down its cities. And it expected to be able to do that easily. And in fact, Western intelligence calculated that it would be able to do that, right? Remember, Kyiv was going to fall in 3 days. And as I was there witnessing this, it struck me that so many of the images I was seeing, the air raid signals in Ukrainian cities, the thousands of civilians boarding trains, fleeing west from the war, people being separated from their children, that these were images that seemed to come from a different time. They could have been stolen out of newsreels, black and white newsreels from the 1930s and 40s. And here I was reporting them live on television in the year 2022.
Yeah, I mean, even the drudgery of sort of the sort of trench-like warfare in eastern Ukraine, I mean, that is very 20th century, isn't it?
It is. And you've seen, it's interesting, we could talk more in detail about this, you've seen a combination of old and new in the warfare, right? Because some of those images of the trench warfare from the Eastern Front in Ukraine, in fact, I tell a story in the book how I was in the office of General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under both Trump and Obama before he recently retired. And he has two pictures in his office of trench warfare, one next to the other. And he pointed them out to me and he said, what's the difference between those two pictures? The difference is 100 years from World War I in Europe to the Ukrainian war in 2022 or 3 or 4, or where we are now, or 25, you know, as it continues. But you also have layered on top of that
drones,
new drones, exactly. The dawn of drone warfare. It's with us now forever. Enormous electronic warfare, new weapons, more advanced weapons, as we've seen Russia use there. So you see a blending of those two old and new technologies, but a very 19th century exercise of power.
So this hybrid overlap of old and new, of tech and sort of dug down, getting your hands dirty in trench warfare, how do you see that then amplifying or multiplying beyond Ukraine? Because yes, you know, in China, we're seeing sort of this a naval threat on that level. But how does the world adjust to this new reality?
Well, we've seen Russia do this in more than just Ukraine. If you go back to, for instance, 2008, Russia sliced off a piece of Georgia then by force of arms. Now it's attempting to do so via political means. We're seeing an occupation growing of the Transnistria region of Moldova. So you've seen other places where Russia has attempted to, either by force of arms or political means or a combination of the two, to slice off pieces of independent countries to attempt to reclaim, you know, that near abroad. So you're seeing it there. You're seeing it in Asia with these escalating exercises around Taiwan, which, of course, the fear is will lead to a full-scale invasion or other attempt to perhaps suffocate, surround, and grab Taiwan. And you see it in, we see it in the Middle East, right? I mean, we certainly see the great powers clashing there on opposite sides of the fronts of those wars.
I mean, look what's happening in Syria right now.
In Syria, yeah. And that, I mean, listen, you know, if you're keeping score in this great power conflict, that is a loss for the Russia, China, Iran, North Korea side of that. And by the way, I didn't mention, yeah, for now. And of course, the pendulum can swing. I didn't mention, but you have North Korea, North Korean forces on the ground in Europe. And, you know, in the 21st century, it's just a remarkable, it evokes images of the last world war.
So is, I mean, and this is no doubt, I mean, the conversations that are happening in Washington, but how does this get contained or how does it metastasize? Yeah. What we're seeing, because this is a pattern, it's post-end of history Fukuyama type stuff, it's breakdown of global institutions or the world order post-Cold War. So if we're in this time of change, how long does this sort of interregnum go on where we see all these shifting sands? Or do you think that there's going to be some tipping point?
Well, this is the new world we live in. You know, when you think of Fukuyama, and by the way, he wasn't the only one who thought that we had put this all behind us in the late 1990s. You and I, who grew up in the Cold War, I imagine you thought, I certainly thought that that dividing line between the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, and the West had dissolved and it was over. In fact, it's been reborn. The lines moved. And the tactics and some of the technologies have changed, but the conflict is the same. And the difference, frankly, is that instead of it being the U.S. and the West against Russia, a single superpower, you now have this marriage to some degree of Russia and China, two superpowers with their kind of little brothers involved more and more, too, of North Korea and Iran. And that makes it fundamentally more challenging. It also brings in more hotspots, more points of contact where the great powers interact and therefore and conflict, frankly, and have the possibility of escalation, sadly, on many of those fronts.
That's a very good point. So the proxy dangers become ever more evident or multiplied. And that's where Syria is such a good example.
Another one is like the Houthi rebels, right? Yeah. Think of this. Here you have... It's an Iranian-backed force in Yemen, which is shut down much of the sea traffic in the Red Sea and through the Suez Canal, except notably for Russian or Chinese-connected ships, right? For some reason, they're shooting at ours and not at theirs. And that's, you know, it shows you that you have these other fronts. You kind of think, oh, perhaps that's unrelated, but in fact, it's part of this same kind of dividing lines, and I've described that in the book, how you could almost take a globe and you could draw a V down it, sort of a, you know, on this side, you've got the split between Russia and its partners to the extent it has them, and then Europe on this side coming down through the Middle East and then up this way through Asia, China and the various places where U.S. allies conflict with China and North Korea, like North and South Korea, Taiwan. The tension between Japan and China as well.
So if this is the new normal, this sort of realigning balance of power, where you're looking at this axis, this quadruple axis of whatever you want to call it, how cohesive are they? Because, I mean, again, they're not ideologically naturally bed partners, are they?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it's you don't want to exaggerate the commitment in this marriage, as it were, because they have, you know, Russia and China have their own interests, as do Iran and North Korea. That said, it's notable that I wrote a book a few years ago called The Shadow War in 2019, which talked about these dividing lines and an increasing partnership between Russia and China and how they have been working to bring down the U.S.-led international order, to weaken the U.S. At the time when I asked intelligence officials and diplomats and others how tight the relationship was between Russia and China, they would say, listen, it's pretty much a marriage of convenience. They will cooperate when they see an advantage. Other times they won't. That's changed. It's become much tighter now because they calculate calculate they're stronger together in terms of standing up to and weakening the U.S. and its allies and standing up to and weakening this U.S.-led, rules-based international order, right? You know, it sounds kind of, you know, wonky, but it's a sort of lattice work that has survived since the Second World War. They calculate it's in their interest, and more, Iran and North Korea brought into that fold as well, that they need each other to stand up. I mean, look at Russia. Russia actually needs North Korean artillery to continue to fight the war in Ukraine. They need North Korean soldiers now. Russia needs Iranian drones.
Yeah.
Iran is thinking, what can I get in return from this? Some missile technology, perhaps, maybe some nuclear technology. You know, Russia needs China to buy its oil now, which China is very happy to do at a great discount because we're not buying it anymore. You know, it works. It works, and it serves their strategic interests.
So then the question is, and this is what, I've spent a lot of time trying to think this out. And I mean, I don't know if we, you know, obviously Washington is gaming this out and has to some extent. There's been I'm going to sound like some hawk here, but there seems to have been a reticence or an over-reliance on deterrence or the sort of fearfulness of provoking either the bear or the, you know. And how has that, I mean, is America going into this Trump administration weaker than, say, the first Trump administration?
Well, listen, I mean, you'll certainly hear that from the Trump people, right?
This is including the first Trump. You know what I mean? This is the last 10 years.
You'll hear from Trump folks that, well, the war in Ukraine would never have happened if Trump was president. Russia has made a strategic decision. It wants to absorb Ukraine. And that, by the way, if you listen to Putin, Ukraine doesn't even exist, right? Yeah. He creates his own history. That's not going to change because of the result of our elections. In terms of how the West reacts, you know, I think a good example of this is the ongoing debate about weapons supplies to Ukraine to defend itself. You had this at each new request for a new category of weapons. There was this debate in the Biden administration about, well, should we really send them tanks or would that be escalatory? Should we really send them HIMARS, long range, rocket and medium range rocket and missile system? Or would that be, you know, eventually they came around and then it was the ATACMS and it was F-16s to doing it. But there's been some criticism that, and certainly from Ukrainians, that had you given it to us earlier, we would have been able to, we might even been able to win. You know, the concern from the Biden administration side had been, well, if we poke the bear too much, we might end up in a wider war, and we don't want that.
But yes, the sort of fear of escalation seems to be, you know, I think a CIA guy that I once spoke to, who's a Democrat, was like, the Obama and Biden administrations are a bunch of professional hand-wringers. And, you know, at what point do we reach the point, even with Trump's instincts to be an isolationist and anti-interventionist, where is this going?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, I mean, listen, to that criticism, it's, you and I have heard that debate regarding virtually every war of the last 30, 40 years, right? I mean, if you look at the Iraq
war, the generals are always going to want to go further than the politicians.
Right. Yeah. We shouldn't have gone in at all, or we should have gone harder. And had we gone harder, we would have won, you know? Mm. I mean, that's like the debate of the Vietnam War still raging today. So it's a natural one, right? And it's, I understand the fear of escalation, right? Because you don't want to end up in a shooting war between NATO and Russia. And, you know, Russia is a lot quicker in its military planning to use nuclear weapons than we are, certainly. And you could imagine all the
They did think about it. I mean, if you listen to the MI6 and CIA chiefs, when was it, at the FT conversation a few months ago, they said it was,
I got
it was
a whole
really
chapter
on,
in my book.
You do, I remember.
About just how close they came in the fall of 2022, Russia did, to using a nuclear weapon there. So, listen, I get that fear. Mm. On the flip side, listen, Russia had already invaded a country in Europe with the intent of absorbing it and was leveling cities and, you know, glide bombs and drones and attacking civilians and rolling tanks across the border. You know, should the West have stepped up more quickly? Perhaps. Now, there were a lot of folks who, when the invasion happened, thought the West would just get bored immediately. In fact, the support has remained. And NATO has expanded. It hasn't split. It's added two new members in Finland and Sweden. So, you know, it's between the two extremes of total war and running away. You know, we live in this middle space here, and there's a lot of debate as to who got what right. But, you know, what happens now?
Yeah, what?
And I have a chapter in the book on this, too, about Trump's approach to this. There is great concern among people, by the way, expressed by people who worked for him in his first administration, John Kelly, John Bolton, Mark Milley, that Trump will pull back that support entirely and look to cut some sort of deal, which Ukrainians and others fear will not be in their interest, that it will push them to give up more than they want to. We'll see. You know, the Trump camp's argument is that he's tough. And he's an unknown quantity. He might scare Putin into, you know, relenting. My personal view is that strategic interests don't change with personalities. And Russia has calculated it's in their strategic interest to absorb Ukraine. They're not going to give it up, whether it's you, me, Trump, Biden, Harris, you know, whoever is occupying the White House.
Or if Trump, tries to sort of woo them with a big, beautiful chocolate cake, you know, as he's tried before. So then that comes to, I mean, in many ways, whatever happens in Ukraine, and I know J.D. Vance has said some things about it, it is going to be interesting in terms of the playing fields. China's calculation and what they're seeing from this and their perspective, I mean, you spent a lot of time in China, their perspective of this Trump 2.0 presidency, and particularly with these alliances and the decisions they're making around Taiwan and what that means.
Yeah. Well, let's see. First, relating to Taiwan, as I was researching this book, there is no one I spoke to in Europe, in Asia, here in the States, any intelligence agency building, Defense Department, etc., who did not make a direct connection between Ukraine and Taiwan, in that China is watching Russia's experience in Ukraine, both on the battlefield, but also in terms of the international reaction and the costs imposed on Russia via sanctions, etc., watching those to measure how the world would react if it were to invade Taiwan, and for how long and how strongly, and therefore could Beijing, could China absorb those costs? It goes into their calculus. They're watching closely. And you can argue they've gotten some mixed messages, right? I mean, to some degree, on the one hand, the West has maintained support for Ukraine. It's been a very bloody and long war and costly war for Russia. On the other hand, there are signs of exhaustion in this country and in Europe. And I imagine she is looking and saying, Trump might pull back from this war. And that might indicate to me, Xi Jinping, that if I were to invade Taiwan, it's a survivable cost. And I'll just tell a story that I have in the book. John Bolton told the story to me that when Trump was president first time around, when the issue of Taiwan came up and the Chinese threat to Taiwan, Trump would pick up a Sharpie and he'd be sitting at the desk in the Oval Office and he would point to the tip of his Sharpie and say, see this? This is Taiwan. And look at the resolute desk in the Oval Office and say, that's China. To make the point that Taiwan, tiny little Taiwan, could not stand up to China, and therefore we have no business defending it. So there's a perception of the people who worked for Trump, I should say, not just me guessing here, that if China were to invade, Trump would not want to get in the middle of it and say that's not our battle, which is a frequent refrain of the America Firsters.
And also, he's won an election based on almost saying that. I mean, you're the right. Americans that you and I mean, I'm down here in the South. I know you're up there more in the North. But, you know, he got into power across the board on saying that he wanted what's it called? Strength, peace through strength, which is essentially isolationist and anti-interventionist. Yeah. So
it was not a secret plan. It was not sort of like hatched in, you know, quiet conversations in Mar-a-Lago. He was very public about this, as is his vice president-elect and many of the folks that he's brought into his administration. Now, I will say, if you look at some of his appointees and at this point, some of them, like Marco Rubio at State, Mike Waltz, National Security Advisor,
these were
folks who were very... But they're China hawks for sure,
and
very supportive of Ukraine in the early days of the war. In fact, Mike Waltz has been someone who said we should push harder, we should give them more weapons, we should let them strike inside Russia, etc. Now, but they're not the boss, so they might advise him that. But as you and I have seen through years of covering the man, Trump does what he wants often.
So Xi Jinping is sort of going to weigh this up, and I'm trying to, you know, looking at it from the metrics that Beijing is viewing this. Trump, you know, and I know you've also written a book on this, the sort of madman theory that, you know, yes, he maybe has gone into power with the American people saying we don't want to get our hands dirty in other people's mess. You know, there's a natural inclination, I think, in this country for isolationism. It goes back way, you know, almost to those founding fathers. Mm. There is an instinct here that I've not seen in other places where I've covered. So, but as Harold Macmillan used to say, events, dear boy, events can impact a president's decision making. And while, yes, he may be saying he's going to do one thing, we know Trump. He might do the complete opposite.
Yeah,
if she comes in, you know, Xi Jinping decides to start throwing around a few sticks in Taiwan.
Well, think of the events, you know, in Syria, right? I mean, here, no one that I know of was predicting that Assad would fall in the matter of days and you would have Iran's chief pal in the Middle East, right, disappear into the smoke, right? And by the way, Russia getting pushed back as well, because that was Russia's partner there and those Russian military bases in Syria. So you can have, I mean, the surprises happen and the changes, the balance. So you don't know. And I think you could reasonably call that a change on the positive side, but who knows what the next war will look like.
Jim Sciutto there, CNN's chief national security analyst and anchor, also a former colleague, and the author of the book, The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. So Jim and I have been talking about sort of the macro issues, the bigger issues around Trump and the world and what this year, what this administration might bring in terms of geopolitics. Well, next week, I'm going to drill down with Jim the issue of China. Jim was chief of staff to the U.S. ambassador for a chunk of time before he came to CNN. So he's worked in Beijing, and he has an interesting perspective on that time and also how it reflects now. That conversation, the sort of micro politics around China and the U.S. and what to expect, the kind of gaming out of scenarios, I'm going to drop that next week. So please stick around and listen to that when it comes out. So part two next week. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Robin Curnow. Please go to the website. It's searchingforamericapod.com. There you can sign up to my weekly newsletter and also listen to some of the previous episodes and whatnot. So thanks again and Happy New Year.